tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Once upon a time, there were millions of people who lived in wretched, poverty-stricken slums, filthy, disease-ridden. Their government decided to make them a big country. And to do this, it went to war against other countries, built itself into a giant military power to give its citizens the big life, the good life, the better life, a virtual utopia. The more powerful they got, the higher their standard of living, however, the greater their problems of urban blight and sprawl, growing pollution, smog-ridden cities, and of course, rising crime, where more and more people tried to take things away from their neighbors. Two, they began to find disease epidemics as their health gradually worsened in their newfound utopia. And to combat those epidemics, massive inoculations were attempted. Eventually, the nation went back to a complete collapse in an agrarian revolution because tens of thousands were once again starving to death and living in poverty-stricken, blighted slums. This is a rather dismal look at history, to be sure, and yet it's a sort of a microcosm of what has happened to one great empire and one city-state and one society after another. And if we're not all collectively very careful, it could be the story of all of humankind when all of us return from our great societies, our grand designs, our striving for utopia to a terrible state of abject poverty. For nearly 6,000 years of recorded history, man has striven to find utopia, the good life. You can call it anything you'd like. What would you like to call it? You can call it happiness, peace, prosperity. We've had political slogans like peace with justice. But the good life certainly begins at home. When you start to ask yourself, what is it that really makes up the good life? It's got to begin, I would say, and thus underline the reason for the success of the overnight springing up like mushrooms of the thousands of gymnasiums and health places and health food stores with personal health and well-being. You got to have a good heart and good lungs and good eyesight and good strong bodies with good muscle tone to be able to enjoy life, the good life. So certainly health precedes happiness, but health, happiness, vitality, a feeling of comfort, a feeling of reward, a feeling of security, a womb-like environment free from pain, from anxiety, what we don't want are fears and worries, thwarted feelings of frustration. We don't want murder or crime when it affects us, oh, we'd like to watch it happening to other people to entertain us as we ourselves avoid any crime. Or as we ourselves avoid being beaten over the head and robbed or mugged or our purses snatched if we're a lady walking along our own quiet little community. But we don't mind watching others have these traumatic situations occur to them vicariously. But what is it, this private search of yours? Let's analyze it for a moment. We all want certain things in life. Maybe we don't put the right handle on them, reach out and say the right things about them. But we want more of this world's goods. We usually translate it in terms like a longer vacation or higher pay or we want perhaps to live in a different place or we want less of smog or less of crime or less of disease or we wish we were happier. However it is, we're really just saying that we want a kind of a utopian environment, that we want all of these conditions that are wrong, that are evil, that are bad and unenjoyable to be replaced by conditions that are beneficial and pleasant and happy. Now, these are translated into political slogans back through 6,000 years of recorded history, they have been. Whether it's called a great society, a grand design, whether it's been called a new society or utopia. Whether you go clear back in the original pages of the book of Genesis, the Bible, where it talks about all of humankind at that time getting together to build a great massive symbol, which had sex origins, by the way, out in a plain as the sort of a representative of their entire society, and they would have a grand society. Well, you see the disintegration of that society recorded. And you see then in the so-called cradle of civilization, the Babylonian area, the Tigris-Euphrates confluence there, the valley, the beginning of the first civilization that we know in recorded history of Mesopotamia, the ancient city of Babylon, others that came along after that time, the experiments in utopia, one totalitarian state replacing another, always with the idea of attempting to give its people the great life, the grand life, the perfect life, everything that is good for them and right for them, guaranteed in perpetuity, prosperity, happiness, the total welfare state from the cradle to the grave of everything that is good and wonderful and all that we want. All of our slogans, whether we're talking about civic organizations, love, peace, brotherhood, fellowship, all of these things, laudatory, they all have them. You may not realize this, but even in some of the documents of communism, and most middle Americans know very little about what communism really is, they just say, he must be a communist. And that is if they don't know who you are and they disagree with you. Now, maybe it changed since the late 50s and the early 60s, when the word communist was the same as the word criminal. The two went hand in hand. It might shock you to realize that many of the aspects of communism are utopian in nature, that many of the slogans about giving people the good life, about equality, brotherhood of man, brotherly love, all of these Christian principles, even though communism is basically atheistic, would nevertheless be slogans to which even Christian churches could subscribe. And there may be a lesson in that somewhere. So on down through history, one government after another has had its bright young champion, whether in the form of a Nebuchadnezzar or an Alexander the Great, or even a Fidel Castro, an Adolf Hitler, or perhaps a Nikita Khrushchev in times gone by, who would say, follow me, I will be your leader. My grand design, my great society, my idea of the super state, of creating the ultimate society in which everybody's individual and collective desires are satisfied, is finally going to lead us into utopia. For thousands of years, history records the blood-spattered pages of one war after another, as this government or the other sought to follow the messianic promises of yet another bright young conquering hero who promised a good life for all of its citizens. And actually, it is usually an impractical and often impossible scheme for any government to finally achieve, whether you're talking about Hitler's fancied 1,000-year Reich, which is nothing more than a bizarre satanic twist to the biblically stated millennial reign of Jesus Christ himself that is revealed in the book of Revelation in the Bible, or whether you're talking about other lesser claims of men that have come along even since, each in his own turn a leader who sought to usher in that great era of utopia, of peace and plenty, prosperity, happiness, harmony, goodness, all these slogans, for everybody. Man has dreamed from time immemorial. Fable, tradition, all cultures have these dreams preserved in their art, their literature, and their music, oftentimes about the land far off somewhere, that idyllic oasis where everything is beautiful, where there is nothing but dancing girls with jewels in their navels and nothing but happiness and springs of flowing water, which is really, in a sense, the one of the Middle Eastern religions' form of heaven that they look at. Of course, they live in a desert climate, so the idea is that heaven has got to be replete with lots of free-running brooks and streams. In Greek, the word utopia actually means nowhere. Maybe there's a takeoff on nirvana, then, state of being nowhere, out of sight, like in outer space. Man has dreamed that maybe there was a secret Shangri-La over in Tibet, or a secret idyllic island paradise out in the South Pacific. As a matter of fact, in our distraught and tension-ridden 1960s and 1970s, there have been any number of modern-day sagas where people have gone off of their campers and trailers, or they boarded a ship together and gotten a community together, and they tried a communal form of living in this or that or the other imagined idyllic wilderness, whether it was Alaska or the South Pacific or the pig farm, a hippie commune north of Albuquerque. In nearly every single case, those ideal societies failed. Now, history tells us there were lots of them. Plato, and he lived from 428 to 348 B.C., and his Republic mapped out a Spartan state run by benevolent philosophers, defended by a secondary caste of warriors, and supplied with the necessities of life by a mass of farmer artisans whose only political role was to obey. Plato did away with the two obstacles that we have in the Western world, that is, the private property and the family, and that sometimes is a despot's idea of creating the perfect society, is get rid of the family and all private property. In the Republic, the lowly toiler's ignorance is his bliss, his state of not knowing and therefore not comparing and therefore remaining happy, such as you don't know that a commode is a commode, you can think it is a flower pot. Well, then what difference does it make? If you grow flowers in it, you don't know that it's supposed to contain running water. So, in 1516, along came Thomas More, who wrote his Utopia. It existed on an island, contained 54 planned cities. Population was kept constant, agriculture was regulated, produce of the state was given directly to the public in community markets, a kind of a communism idea. Augustine wrote his City of God back in the 400s A.D. his idea of utopia, John Bunyan, his Pilgrim's Progress in 1678, and Tommaso Campanella, his City of the Sun, and Francis Bacon in 1627, the book called New Atlantis, and more recently H.G. Wells produced Modern Utopia, that was in 1905. There are certain common elements that bind all of these together clear back to the ancient days of Babylon and even to Plato, and that is that the utopian society solves every major problem of human life. Faith is placed in a collective that owns and controls all property, so you remove all the fears and the worries and striving to make ends meet and all sense of responsibility. Everything is ordered by those most capable of doing so, of course, so it requires a Superman to lead with godlike qualities. In Plato's Republic, it's the guardians. In Bacon's New Atlantis, it was the Solomon House scientists. And in others, it was the Industrial Council, a kind of a big brother society, a quartet of superior men, or a panel of super psychologists. All of these otherworldly utopian ideas, propounded by great philosophers, seers, writers of their day, have in turn proved to be the stuff of nightmares, bizarre dreams of another netherworld that has never come to pass, and under human government, never can. Every nation on the face of this earth wants peace. Every one of them. The Soviet Union, Red China, Japan, the EEC, African nations, Central and South American countries, and certainly we in the United States and Canada. The only trouble being they want peace in different ways, under different means, and achieved by different methods. And peace means one thing to the Russians and something else to people in the United States. In times past, Persians, Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, not necessarily in that order, all wanted peace for their own people, prosperity, a utopian existence, and also, since they wanted it for their own people, they figured that they owed and deserved, that it was deserved by other people, and they owed to give it to other people, and so they went to war to force those other people to be as happy as they were. And so one empire would absorb, crush, conquer, and trample underfoot another empire, always, of course, to bring peace. Because one can't be at peace when one's neighbors are warlike. So the idea is you will either be peaceful or I will kill you. This has happened on down through history. In the 1800s in the United States, there were over 100 attempts made to establish utopian societies. As a matter of fact, in the early 1800s, Frenchman Charles Fourier set up no less than 27 American utopian experiments, all based on his utopian idea of man's fundamental goodness. His communes quickly divided and splintered and split up and died over dissension, ineptitude, and sheer tomfoolery, as a matter of fact. In each of these experiments, intimacy bred discord. All of the human greed, vanity, jealousy, lust, inability to get along, lack of brotherly love and harmony, everything was there until very quickly each one of these utopian experiments, they all splintered and fragmented and were destroyed. Attempted utopian societies were not limited just to the United States, though, because Adolf Hitler sought utopia in his Third Reich, and Karl Marx wrote of a communist society, which was supposed to be like a kind of a utopia. In 1917, the Russians, under Lenin, planned to set up Marx's utopian dream. Abundance of consumer goods, universal happiness, absolute equality, all of the great slogans, peace at home, peace abroad, a government that would hardly need to govern, everybody be so happy and so filled with abundance and prosperity. In reality, though, the Russian government clamped down with an iron grip, and every move to a better life took away the individual's personal freedom. Many consumer goods became in short supply, still are today, except for lots of armaments, of course. The beautiful Marxian dream society turned out to be a police state. Today, communist China is striving to remake human nature in the Maoist image. Precious are the thoughts of Chairman Mao. Because of Mao Zedong's conviction that human nature is essentially good, he's trying to create a new man, one who is selfless, disciplined, doggedly industrious, and willing to live and die without any thought whatsoever of personal ambition that is absorbed into an all-consuming state with these fantastic and lofty and grandiose ideas of self-discipline and of selfless giving to the perpetuation of that marvelous state in which he lives. Although it would appear, and visitors to Red China of recent date have appeared to say that this is true, that Mao is achieving some of his goals, still there is a massive population problem, a shortage of life necessities, periodic uprisings, fear of Russian invasion, growing awareness of Western ways of living. In Russia in particular, they began to find terrible problems with alcoholism, and the Russian government looking over its shoulder rather nervously at various Western styles beginning to be adopted, and especially the invasion of American rock music. All of these, of course, mar the Russian idea and the Chinese idea of utopia. So in the final analysis, two major concepts were assumed and mixed in together with every last one of man's utopian experiments. And these are really basic, and we ought to take time to think about them. One is that man himself is fundamentally good. That man himself is a marvelous creature, but that he is debased by his environment, which may mean his fellow man, if that fellow man is a different color, or speaks a different language, or doesn't agree with this first man's idea about the way of things. Secondly, that man is a completely plastic creature, able to be entirely molded by his surroundings. That the right kind of a womb-like environment, the utopian experiment, free from all these responsibilities and major concerns, would create a tranquil, ever happier human being. Either way, the right society, it was thought, would quickly set all the evils right, would straighten out every crooked road, and would make man, finally, at peace with himself, and, if there was a religious connotation to it, with his God. Generally, utopian dreamers fail to realize that man's nature, not his physical environment, nor the rule nor the form of government, is the key to attainment of any kind of sense of peace and tranquility, and any utopian dream of any sort. That all other elements are secondary to man's nature. So somewhere along the line, some of these men just didn't really know what human nature was all about. They didn't know what human nature basically was. They didn't begin their utopian experiment with the idea that man's nature has been proven over the course of more than 6,000 years, or almost 6,000 years, of recorded history, to be vanity primarily, or egotistical primarily, and egocentric. Vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. And again, not necessarily in that order. Maybe greed is the most obvious motive that drives your neighbor, and maybe vanity is yours. Maybe you would say, I don't have any vanity, which is a terribly vain statement to make all by itself, actually. I don't think any of us can say that, and that includes me, and it includes you, because that is part and parcel of human nature. As one editor put it, the beating of swords into plowshares throughout the world is a laudable objective, and one whose pursuit we would in no wise seek to discourage. But in all realism, its achievement will require the shaping of human nature into a different and far more responsive pattern.
A nation is only as strong as its family. If our nation were as strong as your family, how strong would it be? And if relationships in your family are not what you would like, where can you go for help? Plain Truth, a publication of understanding, is concerned. Every Plain Truth brings you helpful articles on how relationships can be strengthened between husband and wife, parents and children, families and neighbors. With interesting and useful information on helping your child enjoy learning at home and school, budgeting and sensible use of credit, preventing teenage depression, household health and safety, homemaking tips for the working mother, achieving full human potential, coping with inflation. Plain Truth emphasizes quality in all aspects of daily living. Let Plain Truth help strengthen your family and nation. Request your free subscription today. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
I am not taking part in a utopian experiment, no matter what you may have heard about Ambassador College in magazine articles or elsewhere you may have read of it. Visitors who come to Ambassador College at its Pasadena, California campus, and also the Big Sandy, Texas campus, about halfway between Shreveport and Dallas on the old Highway 80 there, always seem to compare, I think Ambassador College forces comparisons, with other institutions and with the world at large in general. And they talk about there being an idyllic setting, almost like it is out of the mainstream of the swirling vortices of problems and difficulties in the world at large, and that here is a little island in the middle of chaos and turbulence, a tranquility and a peace. Well, maybe that is an automatic thing that happens because here on Ambassador College campuses there are a lot of people who are striving to work on human nature, to overcome their own natures. Now, I believe that there is a God. Still there? Oh, yeah, there you are. I believe there is a God. I have proved there is a God, and the existence of God has been demonstrated time and again in classrooms where I have taught, as well as in series on this program in the past, not only by disproving evolution, but from any sense of logic, and certainly by proving whether or not the Bible is the revealed and the inspired Word of God. You don't need to believe in God to believe that human nature, in all of its many guises, colors, races, and creeds, the outlet for human nature and its expression as it's been orchestrated in governments down through the years of the nearly 6,000 years of human experience, has resulted in the world coming to the place today where we are now capable of vast cosmicide. Where before, when, say, Attila's Huns in their hordes, they always ran about in hordes in those days, swept across European cities and destroyed them utterly, burning everything to the ground, at least the capacity for the total destruction of all the humankind was not then present. So you might be safely able to wrap up the entirety of all history in one little nerd, you might say there, to say the following, that in the course of nearly 6,000 years of human history, we have managed, in all of our many failures, to achieve a utopian society, to bring ourselves to the brink of nuclear cosmicide. We can say to ourselves, to science maybe, if we want to blame science, or to all of us, congratulations. We have come to the great society now, to the place where we in this world have reached the capacity to kill everybody on the face of the earth by about five different methods. And then you begin to wonder, will we do it? It seems to appear as you look about in bewilderment at the chaotic disarray between and among governments and at our own government's chaotic disarray that we're not about to achieve any utopia, but we're about to achieve total, organized, deliberate chaos. And sometimes you wonder if that wasn't planned too. So if you see Ambassador College campus on a visit and you're forced into making any sort of a comparison, let me tell you right now, it's not an experiment in a utopian environment. We know what the pressures are and what the problems are. But you see, we're beginning from a completely different premise. And that premise is based upon the Word of Almighty God in the Bible. The Bible is the book about human nature. It's like the handbook that comes with the manufacturer that tells you exactly what this product is all about, who made it, what its purpose and its goals and objectives are, how to best use it, how to repair it when it breaks down. And that handbook from the Creator of mankind tells us what we are. In one specific magazine article not long ago, I was pretty much given what for, and my father, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, and a lot of other people associated with us because of our approach, let's say, or our attitude toward our own nature, which we say is vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed, which we say has been demonstrated and proved by the blood-spattered pages of history and the lesson written in the blood of tens of millions of humankind to be, basically, ego-serving, vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. Now, I don't really think that's a bizarre religion to say that. I think it's mere frank admission of what human nature basically is. Taking that approach, which is a Bible approach, you can put it, I guess, in more theological-sounding terms, which goes something like this. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Or it goes something like this. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. You see, because the Bible shows that we are above all things deceitful, that we above all things are hypocritical and two-faced, that the human being is double-minded, that it is a collection of vanity, selfishness, lust, resentment, pride, greed, hostility, that we resent and we rebel against authority imposed upon us. So we approach it from a biblical point of view that shows man's inferior state, not his superior state. And we say, we've got to get better than we are, but we can't do it by ourselves. We look in the Bible and it says, choose. Choose whether you will reap the evil or whether you'll reap and harvest the good. It says, choose whether you'll live by God's laws and His ways that produce the good things you really want. Or you can choose to do the opposite by simply putting off the choice to live the right way, according to God's laws. And God's laws aren't bad for us. After all, what's bad about the command that says, thou shalt not steal? You want your neighbor to obey it. You want everybody else in society to obey it. Now, maybe you don't. And maybe when you're 16 visiting the Five and Dime, you don't. They don't have any Five and Dimes anymore. Probably get quarters and halves. Anyhow, they had stores like that. Maybe you could carry that further to any one of the Ten Commandments you would like. And if it were obeyed by any society or by any segment of society, that segment of society would directly reap the rewards and the benefits from being obedient to that one part of God's law. So we approach it from the point of view that the Bible says that humankind is not basically good, that it's basically evil, but that it needs the help of God Almighty to be better than it is. We call upon God for that help, acknowledging to God that we are basically vain, jealous, lustful, prideful, egotistical, and ask Him to help us not to be that way, but to replace those motivations with a motivation of brotherly love, of concern for our fellow human being, of being on the giving side instead of the getting side, and we're involved in a work that is doing precisely that, trying our very level best to give knowledge, or if you want to call it opinions and you want to disagree, that's fine too, but at least give thought. Give something at least people can stand up and disagree with, and not just take womb-like without having to think, as it just fed through them in a never-ending stream over the various media. But give nevertheless, as we're trying to give you a very worthwhile magazine, subscription to one year after year if you want to renew free of charge, and also these booklets such as this one that goes through the purpose in human life. Just why are we here? Why were we born? Why did we come into the world in the first place? Every single day in your newspapers or the television news, you're hearing of horrible stories of people who put an end to themselves, who murder themselves, or a murder-suicide pact or something because people are simply fed up with life. Now here we are, in a world where science has bequeathed upon us the ability to destroy ourselves before we ever found out why we are here. What is your own personal goal in life? What are you doing here? What are you after? Most people have a lot of hazy, vague, unrealized dreams. You can just call them kind of private little daydreams of ours that we sort of hope someday some great, wonderful, magnificent thing is going to happen to us. Matter of fact, there's one fellow that always says, something good is going to happen to you. And I like to think that that's true. Maybe something good is going to happen to you, and you hope it's good. But really, psychologists, psychiatrists will tell you that most people live these things vicariously. They don't really live them themselves. Most people witness and watch and observe and read about and go to movies and enjoy, stuffing popcorn in their face, watching somebody else vicariously enjoy the things they've always hoped and kind of daydreamed about that they would like to enjoy. But they themselves don't seem to really fulfill any definite purpose. There may have been never a time in your entire life where you sat down, you just asked yourself, what am I? Who am I? How far have I come? What do I own? What is the sum total of my education? What do I possess? How much fun, excitement, reward have I had? What have been the bad times? Do the bad times outweigh and counterbalance the good times? Am I really getting out of life what I want? I don't know, come to think of it, whether I'd recommend people do that before they write for this booklet. You better not do that. You better get the booklet first, because I think most people, if they sat down and did that, they would be so miserable that they might make a wrong decision and go out and do something rather horrible. So write for this booklet on why were you born? What is the real purpose in human life? Does life, after all, have any real meaning? It goes into the origin, the question of where we came from, the question of human survival, how we are creatures not of instinct but of brain, whether or not science has run a little amok and lost its way in giving us, we human mortals, the wherewithal to annihilate ourselves but not really telling us what we are. What is the real cause of evil in the world? And are we really God's workmanship or did we just happen? It's in this booklet, Why Were You Born? Write for it right away. Before you forget it, jot the address down, get the letter off right away today. Don't put it off till tomorrow. This booklet needs to be in the mail to you as soon as we can get it on its way. All you need to do is to write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. That's the only address you need, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for your free copy. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.